And with that, I'd like to hand it over to our first speaker, who is Dr. Amy Middleman. She's an Associate Professor of Pediatrics in the Adolescent Medicine and Sports Medicine section at the Baylor College of Medicine. She's Director of the Pediatric Core Clerkship and also serves as the Section Editor in Adolescent Medicine for the online textbook UpToDate. She is the medical editor of two books published in June 2006 entitled The Girl's Guide to Becoming a Teen and The Boy's Guide to Becoming a Teen, and she has conducted research regarding immunizations among adolescents for many years. Dr. Middleman?
Thank you so much, Shannon. I'm really honored to be here, and thank you very much for asking me to participate. I'm going to be talking about adolescent immunizations. What are the barriers? My disclosures are listed as on this slide and as presented earlier. The goals for this 15-minute portion of the session are really for participants to understand what the current recommendations are for adolescents, what public policies have been and may be successful in the future at increasing adolescent immunization rates, and how providers themselves can improve immunization rates in the clinical setting. So I first wanted to show you an adolescent immunization schedule. This is a little bit different from the one you'll see on the CDC website. This was created specifically for the Society for Adolescent Health and Medicine. So this schedule spans the vaccine recommendations for those adolescents aged 10 to 25. And as you can see, it's pretty full. It's a full schedule as opposed to what was happening really in the 80s and 90s when there were really at most two vaccines recommended for adolescents, the TD booster, which has been recommended for adolescents for a long time and in 1996 was specifically recommended for those 11 to 12 years of age. And then in the mid-90s, there was a recommendation for adolescents for catch-up hepatitis B vaccination. And since that time, up until 2005, there were no other specific recommendations for vaccines, or I should say universal recommendations for vaccines for adolescents. And in 2005, we got the recommendation for the meningococcal vaccine. So you can also see from this slide that the Healthy People 2020 objectives have expanded from the 2010 objectives to include the vaccines that have been recommended since 2005. The way that the 2020 objectives were developed was to look at the baseline immunization rates for the vaccines listed in the table and then to project what the goal rate should be by 2020. And this table obviously includes Tdap, varicella vaccine, the meningococcal vaccine, human papillomavirus vaccine, and annual flu vaccine for those 13 to 17 years of age. And so we're really looking at goals that are significantly higher in terms of the goal rate compared to the baseline rates in 2008. We're all hopeful we can achieve these goal rates by 2020. The NIS teen refers to the National Immunization Survey that looks at teen vaccination rates. And the rates that are looked at are specifically for those 13 to 17 years of age. These data have been collected since 2006. And so there are now 5 years worth of data to review. And if you look across the table on your slide, you can see that the vaccination rates have gone up really nicely over the last 5 years. So we talk a lot about this difficulty in accessing adolescents and making sure they get vaccinated. We're actually doing pretty well. When you look at in childhood and infant immunization rates, you know, the DPT, for example, has been in existence since the 1940s. So we've had a long time to really achieve those 90% and greater rates that we enjoy for infants and children. But we haven't had as long to really implement and watch the progress for adolescents. And I think if you look at this table, it's very encouraging that, for example, the meningococcal vaccine has only been recommended for 5 or 6 years, and yet we're already at immunization rates, at least for the first dose, of nearly 63%. I think the concerning numbers are on the last line of your table, where we're really struggling with HPV vaccine. I think there are a number of reasons for that, including the target disease, that really have complicated the issue of getting immunization rates high for HPV vaccine. But regardless of the vaccine, I think that we've made a lot of progress, but as you can see from the numbers, we have a ways to go before we really get to vaccination coverage rates that are going to protect the majority of our adolescents in this country. So how do we do that? This slide really sort of summarizes a lot of the issues. I'm not going to spend too much time on this slide. There's a lot of small print. But really, I think that what I'm trying to show with this slide is that in the outer ring, the sort of orange and red ring, you can see there are a lot of public policies that we can implement to target adolescents and get the shots in arms. And the green ring around the bullseye really indicates what providers can do and patients can do that we know has been really effective and helpful in terms of getting shots to our adolescent youth. So I'll review just briefly some of the public policy strategies. First, I think it's really important to establish adolescent immunization platforms, and this really sets up a standard immunization visit that parents can sort of hang their hats on and know, oh yes, I know, at 2, 4, 6 months, I get 6 months of age, my child should get a shot, but also at 11 to 12 and then, you know, 15 to 16 years of age or 18 to 19 years of age, my child should also be getting shots. And it sets up an expectation of this that I think makes it easier to remember that kids need shots at this age. The CDC has done a great job of gearing up this 11 to 12 year immunization platform. We have data at this time that clearly indicates that younger adolescents have higher rates of accessing specifically comprehensive preventive health care than older adolescents do. We know older adolescents do go to the doctor, but often it's not specifically for comprehensive health care, and I think it's easier to experience missed opportunities when it's not when a visit is not specifically designated as a comprehensive or preventive healthcare visit. The Society for Adolescent Health and Medicine, since approximately 2005 and 2006, has actually recommended the establishment of multiple immunization platforms during adolescence to really try and catch the adolescents as they go through the adolescent time period in terms of getting missed doses, catching up, and completing multi-dose regimens, and specifically in the older age group, certainly the 18 years of age up through the 19th birthday, we really want to make sure all adolescents get needed immunizations while they're still eligible for the Vaccine for Children program, which of course is an entitlement program that allows adolescents to receive adolescents who may not be covered for vaccination to receive vaccinations through this entitlement program up to the 19th birthday. At this point in time, over 40% of vaccines distributed to children are done so through the Vaccine for Children program. It's a program that has clearly helped us improve vaccination rates across the span of youth. Further steps, policy steps to support adolescent immunization include supporting state mandates that require vaccine administration for school entry, the support of the use of alternative immunization sites, and strengthening reimbursement and supporting insurance reform to make sure that providers get reimbursed for vaccine administration. We know school mandates work. If you look at this slide that presents some data from the early 2000s, we know that for example, when hepatitis B vaccination series were mandated in certain states, the rates of vaccination completion were 75% in those states that had mandates and about 39% in those states that did not have mandates. So we know these mandates work. In Florida as well, we know that were huge increases, 380% increases in vaccines administered to 10 to 14-year-olds in a three-month period, 1 year versus 1 year after versus prior to a state mandate for the vaccines in question. Mandates can also, when sort of implemented appropriately, can help eliminate preventive care disparities among groups. We just need to make sure that all of these programs are appropriately and adequately funded. There's also a projection that if we introduced mandates for HPV vaccine, we would be able to achieve 70% coverage for this vaccine after 8 years of vaccine availability with a mandate versus achieving 70% coverage 23 years after vaccine availability without a mandate. And so I think these sorts of dynamic models really help us see some of the advantages that mandates can provide to us in terms of increasing immunization coverage among adolescents. The use of alternative immunization sites is also a great way to improve immunization rates, basically taking immunizations to the places where adolescents are more likely to show up. And I have a whole list of places there, but clearly most adolescents do at some point attend school. A large percentage of them do, and that seems to be a great place to consider taking immunizations. If you look again at the experience with adolescent hepatitis B vaccination, programs that went into the schools in San Francisco, Baton Rouge, Oregon, Houston, those programs were extremely successful in accessing adolescents. Now, a lot of times when we talk about going to the schools, we talk about going to the schools when there's a new vaccine or we're trying to catch up patients and then sort of move forward from there. So they're, in the past, they've been very sort of time limited and very targeted. So I think what we're starting to talk about is whether or not we can actually utilize these sites in a more consistent manner, and that's creating a lot of great conversation across stakeholders to try and see how that can be done in a way that makes sense. National data clearly indicate that teens' parents are willing to utilize alternative sites, and in particular, I think it's pretty high percentage, 70% definitely or probably would utilize a school health clinic. Now, that's a little bit different than school-located immunization programs. A clinic is sort of an established place on a campus, whereas a school-located immunization program sort of goes into schools and is not necessarily there on a consistent basis, but there on a programmatic basis. I think that overall, though, these data are very encouraging in terms of really making clear that parents are ready for some new sort of alternative methods to reaching their children rather than taking them necessarily always to the primary care site or the medical home. Of course, whenever you talk about alternative sites and you talk about the medical home, it's important to make sure that the medical home knows what is being done outside of the medical home. And so that really also indicates a strong, strong need for immunization information systems where people can input data about vaccinations that have been provided that then primary care providers can access and see at the next visit, oh yes, I see that since I have last seen you in the office, you've gotten a flu vaccine here and you've gotten a meningococcal vaccine here, and we'll just update you at this point. I think immunization information systems are really important. They can be extraordinarily helpful for consolidating fragmented records and keeping track of needed, recommended, or catch-up vaccination across practitioners. They also can provide these systems themselves can provide automated reminder and recall to patients, which is really helpful when you're sort of managing your patients, and I think we'll hear a little bit more about that. Assists in the management of vaccine supply in many cases, if utilized fully, and can actually generate vaccination records for parents and schools and others when without having to necessarily go to an appointment to get those sorts of records or put a request in at the doctor's office and wait a week to 10 days before you get your records. Immunization information systems are recommended by the National Vaccine Advisory Committee and the National Immunization Program. It's really a great way to keep track of vaccines provided outside of the medical home. In addition, they've been shown in research to actually help save money. So, for example, after Hurricane Katrina. There was an article by Julie Boom here at Baylor College of Medicine that indicated that approximately $3 million in resources was saved by Houston and Texas linking up with the Louisiana Immunization Information System called LINC. So there are lots and lots of advantages to using immunization information systems, and I urge everyone to sign on to that, to the system in their area if they haven't already, because although it takes a little bit of time to get used to the system on the front end, it's a great way to help overall track immunizations in the long run. Also, I think available reimbursement for adolescent vaccines is important. A lot of providers talk about the huge amount of funds they have to put forward to buy a lot of vaccines to keep in the refrigerator. But we do know that there's public funding, again, eligible for those up to age 19 years through the VFC program, and a lot of states also cover it through their CHIP programs. For those adolescents who are greater than 19, some states use their Section 317 funds to help out with vaccination payments. Of course, with healthcare reform, we will see how that affects things, and it looks like it will affect things favorably in terms of making sure vaccinations are considered a primary preventive method that is covered. So how can providers help? Well, we know there are missed opportunities in providers' offices. We all get very busy, and one study actually indicated that in one healthcare system, there were so many missed opportunities for providing the TDTDAP immunization to adolescents that missed opportunities were noted in 84% of healthcare visits among that age group. And that's unfortunate. We can all, I think, those of us who see a lot of patients can certainly see how that could happen, but it is a missed opportunity and it's a shame. So we really have to figure out ways to flag ourselves or make sure we always run through an immunization screen when we see our patients, especially our adolescents. What else can providers do? Certainly increasing knowledge regarding vaccine recommendations and vaccine safety, and educating parents about vaccine safety. I think understanding the way vaccine safety information is reported and especially in the media, I think is going to be important. And initiating practices specifically to increase immunization. That's really what our next speakers are going to be talking about. Screening tools and standing orders, the use of ImTrack, perhaps using vaccination quick visits, reminder recall systems, and I think that includes some really unique strategies that we're going to hear more about as our speakers continue. So thank you so much for your attention. Hopefully we'll all learn a little bit more as we go on about some of these ways that providers in particular can increase immunization rates. So thank you so much.